time for this week's edition of Sports Lit 101. Bruce Pratt here in the house with us this afternoon to talk more about a remarkable athletic accomplishment.
Yeah, this book, Race Across America, the title obviously is in a sense a wordplay, because it's not, this time, this book of Charlie Kastner's doesn't just cover the Bunyan Derbies, but it focuses on the five African-American men who started in 1928. And one of the things that I think is important to put in perspective is that most people who have studied any American history know that there were two or three, depending on what school of thought you belong to, what were called the Great Migrations. And they were northward migrations. We're not talking about 19th century. We're talking about the 20th century. Migrations by African Americans to cities like Chicago, St. Louis, on to Cleveland, Philadelphia, New York. That's pretty well known, and that, of course, follows the path of jazz north. And I think, as a people, it's a greater part of our collective conscience than is the same movement to the West Coast. Now, to move to the West Coast was a much more difficult thing to do because it required more money. And the African Americans who could do that were those who had either a really top-notch technical skill and or could read well. And as we know, in the early part of the 20th century, everything was done to prevent black people from having those advantages. Schools, if they existed for black children, were dismal. The instruction was at best okay. Truancy was a problem because people needed to work and help support their families. So it was only people like Eddie Gardner's folks and Toby Cotton Jr.'s folks who could move, because they had been either worked in steel mills or they had worked in other other industries where they could save enough money to get to the West Coast. What's surprising, maybe surprising to a lot of people, is many of the lumberjacks in the woods of northern Washington, southern British Columbia, counted among them Alabamans, black Alabamans who had been timber and pulp harvesters there. Now, obviously, why did these people move? Because once they got north of certain state lines, Jim Crow de jure, that is, you know, legal Jim Crow enforced by law, was not a problem. De facto Jim Crow, as we know, continued and continues in places today. But the really onerous part of not being able to vote, not being able to go to school and the like, was gone when you moved into these other areas. Now, so there were two pockets, if you will, of black migration to the West Coast. This is oversimplifying this, obviously. One was Seattle, Portland, and the other was Southern California. And in Southern California, as LA was growing very, very rapidly, so did a very determined and successful black middle class. And when the Bunyan Derby came around, Charlotte Bass, who was the editor of the black newspaper, the California Eagle, had decided that she was going to fund one of the runners in the hopes that one of the runners would win the Bunyan Derby. And they were trying to do two things, as it was also true of the black newspaper in Pittsburgh, the Pittsburgh Courier. There was this eugenics-based belief that black people had no stamina, which I mentioned last week, and we kind of know is not true. And they wanted to prove that one of their own could run this race. Five men started the race. We talked about Eddie Gardner, about him. But the one I wanted to talk about today is the next one I'll mention, then we'll come back to him. 15-year-old Toby Joseph Cotton Jr., who entered when his father, a Los Angeles auto mechanic, was working beneath a jacked-up truck, which fell and paralyzed him. The father bought a $20 car. Family was in dire straits. But the son, the 15-year-old, would run 30, 40 miles at a time. They decided, well, maybe this would be a way out of poverty. $25,000 at that time would be like winning more than $1 million today. And especially for someone who's, even though they had a skill, their ability to rise up in the world economically wasn't that great. So they take off across the country, and he makes it to the end of the race with some just harrowing experiences on the way. But I also want to mention some of the other people. One of them is Smiling Sammy Robinson, who was from Atlantic City. He was an African American veteran. He was had been a star football player in high school in a racially mixed school, and he had been also good at baseball and track and a lot of other things. And because he had been one of the 400,000 African Americans who signed up to fight in World War One, his old high school teammate, who had become the sports editor of the Atlantic City Daily Press and Atlantic City Union, approached him about competing in the Bunyan Derby, and he offered to help fund that. Sammy left Atlantic City with seven pairs of running shoes and a track uniform, and he did well. He finished. He was given a letter to say he was a representative of the citizens of Atlantic City, hoping that in the Jim Crow South that might help. He came home. Because he had finished the race, he was given a big parade. There was some thought that he would get a sinecure or a job like Johnny Sallow did, perhaps as a policeman. But once the bloom was off the rose, Smiling Sammy Robinson became forgotten. Another person who ran was from Ohio, William O. Frierson from Canton, Ohio. He was a 32-year-old war veteran, an accomplished long-distance walker, and he was one of the two people who entered the race with the belief that a long-distance race walker would have had the best chance of winning because they would be able to continue at a pretty steady pace all the way across while others were vying to win the race differently. That proved to be not a good idea. He did not finish the race. And the last person was one that is really interesting. This is somebody who was greatly conflicted, and I think if we have a heart, we can understand why. His name was Philip Granville, and he was originally from Jamaica. And he told people that he was a light-skinned Jamaican Indian. Now, he was married to an English woman. He lived in Canada. In Canada, he seemed to be regarded as a person of color, but he was able to compete in the race and stay at all the hotels and not face any of the Jim Crow restrictions that Robinson and Gardner and Cotton faced. However, at one point in the race, he did go with them to a rally and talk about the importance of dignity for the people of color in this world, but quickly sort of drew back from that and eased back into that little life that he had constructed for himself. He did obviously not win. But here's the thing. This is just prior to the Depression, yet there were men who were running in overalls, work shoes, because the amount of money that Pyle dangled out there, $25,000 for first, $10,000 for second, and $1,000 all the way down for the next 10, was an astonishing amount of money when the average person in America with a decent job was making $2,500 a year. And so it attracted people who just thought they had the courage to do it. Now, when you think about that with what we know now, there are probably people in this world, ultra marathoners, who could do this today mm-hmm. with far less difficulty. They'd had trainers, nutrition.
Better shoes.
Yeah, better shoes and much better running clothes. They would have watches that would allow them to pace themselves. They would be in touch with technology that these guys couldn't have. And if they were running along the roads, they would not be competing with local traffic. Mm. You know, the roads would be closed wherever they were running, and there would be a pace car. It would be like the Tour de France.
And their lives would not be in danger
right.
places.
And we have throughout this, the case of the Bunyan Derby, people that were hit by cars and had to withdraw or cracked ribs and fought on until the ribs healed. And they're running an average of 44.5 miles a day, rarely on flat ground. I remember discussing this with some Penobscot County track coaches when we first talked about the first of Kastner's book, a couple of years ago, and all of them saying, you know, we think we know tough runners, you know, we know that ultra marathoners. And I have a friend, Fred Mason, who's a very successful ultra marathoner and thinks nothing of running 100 miles. I can't imagine that, but. They're a different mindset. They're born with a different genetic assembly than the rest of us. But they have to have some kind of mental toughness that really probably most of the rest of us couldn't summon up no matter how hard we tried. You add to that being a person of color, carrying the burden of representing an entire race at a time in America when black people are only two generations out of slavery, when the parents of some, grandparents of some of these runners were themselves slaves. It's an astonishing thing to think about that they would have that much courage to leave the relative safety of a Seattle or Los Angeles and run across the country knowing you had to run through Texas, Oklahoma, and Missouri on your way to New York. And later when they came back, they would run through Jim Crow states on the way back. I have to measure that courage with Jesse Owens staring down Hitler, with Ali saying, no, I'm not going to fight for a country that won't give me my full rights. Yeah, I think back of there are many more examples of just incredibly courageous African-American athletes who were the first to do things. You know, and then you think about when it was all over, none of those men really benefited from this in the long run. And they did better than, say, a Booby Miles from Friday Night Live, Friday Night Lights. But they both mostly went back into obscurity, where many of the white runners were rewarded with jobs and connections that led to much better lives and endorsements and the like. So these are really forgotten pioneers, and I hope people will want to read about them, because it's very, very stirring kind of stuff. So the book is called Race Across America: Eddie Gardner and the Great Bunyan Derbies. It's from Syracuse University Press, by Charles B. Kastner, Chuck Kastner to us, former guest of the show, who we hope to have back on soon.
Excellent. And what's ahead in Sports Lit the next couple of weeks?
We're going to have a book called Bird at the Buzzer. I'm not going to say any more about that. And then hopefully we're looking forward to setting up interviews with Pat Melgaris. I think that's how he pronounces it, who wrote Chasing Excellence, Remarkable Life and Inspiring Vigilosophy of Coach Joe I. Vigil, which we talked about several weeks back. The publisher is Solstice Press, and I sent Miles Schrag a note. And I also hope we'll talk to Cecil Harris about Serena Venus and the unfinished black tennis revolution, especially as Serena almost got her final.
Yeah.
That would have tied her with Margaret Court, though I'd argue that Margaret Court might not win a set against Serena Williams. Yeah. If they were playing both in their prime, not to diminish Margaret Court by any means, who was a great champion and had 24 major titles, but Serena's something else.
Oh, yeah. It's a different game.
Oh, yes. I mean, it's sort of like comparing hockey back when the goalie had to stay standing on 2 feet,
right,
to watching Vasilevskiy and people like that play today. You know, it's just not the same.
Absolutely. Well, we look forward to talking about all those great books as we roll into the fall here on Sports Lit.